Hello, and welcome to Plutarch's Greeks and Romans, a podcast taking you on a tour through ancient Greek and Roman history, seen through the lives of the most famous and influential people who lived it, with the ancient historian and biographer Plutarch as our guide and companion. So, today we're going to take on the life of Lycurgus, the legendary lawgiver of Sparta. And when we're talking about Lycurgus, we're still pretty firmly in the realm of legend, rather than history. We're getting closer to history, in my opinion, but still not quite there yet. Plutarch starts his life of Lycurgus by saying, quote, "There is so much uncertainty in the accounts which historians have left us of Lycurgus, the lawgiver of Sparta, that scarcely anything is asserted by one of them which is not called into question or contradicted by the rest." So, that's a bit of a depressing note to start with, Chris.
Yeah, definitely is. But I do have a feeling that Plutarch may have had the same feeling when he was writing the various myths of Romulus that we saw in our last episode. I mean, it's tough, though. I mean, in general, whose version do you go with? And, you know, were there incentives for portraying one version over another? I mean, the other thing that I do admire about ancient history is that it's never 100% provable. And, you know, this leaves a lot of, you know, room for the imagination.
Yeah, and we could be certain that not all of Plutarch's ancient sources survived as well. So the things he left out, who knows, right? And the modern historian Paul Cartledge isn't sure if Lycurgus was a flesh-and-blood person at all, and suggests the possibility that Lycurgus was, in essence, a reified projection of Apollo, under whose divine guarantee his laws were placed. Cartledge points out that the name Lycurgus translates as wolf-worker, and that one of the many epithets applied to the god Apollo was wolfish. Herodotus, the 5th century BC Greek father of history, doesn't really help us clear up the exact status of Lycurgus either. He mentions Lycurgus somewhat briefly in a bit of a sidebar from his main narrative, saying, "The Lacedaemonians had been the worst governed people in the whole of Greece. Domestically speaking, their affairs had been a disgrace. While as for external affairs, well, they had simply refused to have any dealings with foreigners at all. It happened that Lycurgus, a man who was much esteemed among the Spartans, went to consult the oracle in Delphi, and no sooner had he entered the shrine than the Pythia, the priestess, began to address him. 'Here you are, Lycurgus. Come to my rich temple, dear to Zeus and to all who dwell in Olympus. Are you man or god? That is more than I can tell. But on balance, I think you must be a god, Lycurgus.'" So Herodotus' story about Lycurgus doesn't make clear if Lycurgus is a man or a god, but he does go on to say that he introduced major reform to the Spartan constitution, took measures to ensure the changes would take hold, and left the entire constitution greatly improved. So much improved that after his death, the Spartans revered him and raised a temple in his honor.
Wow, that's very interesting. I mean, typically, constitutional reforms sound like the action of a man. But having a temple raised in your honor is something usually reserved for a god. However, many temples would be erected for Roman emperors in the centuries to come.
Yeah, it's a good point. Still not clear if this guy is a man or a god. Oh, and a quick note before continuing. You may have noticed that Herodotus referred to the people of Sparta as both Lacedaemonians and Spartans. The two different words were used interchangeably by the ancients. The same goes for the region of Sparta itself, sometimes called Sparta, other times referred to as Laconia. This is actually where we get the modern word laconic from, which we use to refer to expressing oneself in very few words, because the Spartans were famous for not wasting words and giving short, pithy remarks.
Very cool. See, I could be laconic too.
But anyway, back to Lycurgus. Whether he was a man or a god, it's important to look at the story of his life because of how important he was to the Spartan identity. Because the very unique Spartan constitution, which we find so interesting today, and even other Greeks at the time found so interesting, this constitution was attributed entirely to Lycurgus, and the Spartans revered his memory so much that they rigidly stuck with this really radical way of life for centuries. And we'll see how radical it is in a moment. So given the importance of Lycurgus to the history of the Spartans, who themselves really have an outsized influence on Western civilization, we should be grateful to Plutarch for attempting to penetrate the fog surrounding this legendary figure and giving us a workable biography of Lycurgus. Plutarch starts his life of Lycurgus with this mission statement: "Notwithstanding this confusion and obscurity, we shall endeavor to compose the history of his life, adhering to those statements which are least contradicted, and depending upon those authors who are most worthy of credit." You can't ask for more than that. And Chris, I for one certainly appreciate Plutarch's effort here.
Hear, hear. I second that, buddy. You know, I always wonder when I'm reading Plutarch, you know, what stories or facts were left out and why. I guess we're never going to know.
Nope. But before we get into how Plutarch believes that Lycurgus turned the Spartans into Spartans, I want to back things up a little bit.
Okay, let's back it up.
So, what is Sparta and who are the Spartans, or the Lacedaemonians? Well, if you know Homer, you know that Sparta is the place that the Trojan prince Paris stole the beautiful Helen away from, causing the Spartan king Menelaus to seek the aid of his brother king Agamemnon and the other Greek cities to sail against Troy and, after a long war and siege, to eventually destroy the city.
Wow, is that it? That's probably the most abbreviated version of the story of the Trojan War that I've ever heard. That sums it up nicely.
Yeah, thank you. I'll take that as a compliment. Well, in any event, in the Iliad, the Spartans don't appear to stand out from the other Greek or Achaean soldiers. They appear to have had a lifestyle not unlike the other Greeks. Now, the Greeks or Achaeans in Homer's Iliad have been associated with the Mycenaean civilization, which rose in Greece around the 17th century BC, until eventually collapsing around the 12th century BC. And this disintegration of Mycenaean civilization is perhaps tied to a perfect storm of factors which caused a general collapse of Bronze Age civilization around the Eastern Mediterranean, which left only the Egyptian civilization intact. We don't have time to go into it really here, but Eric Klein wrote a very interesting book about the Bronze Age collapse titled 1177 BC, The Year That Civilization Collapsed, and I recommend it. Before their civilization collapsed, the Mycenaeans had lived clustered around various defensible palace centers and wrote using a script known today as Linear B. After the Bronze Age collapsed, Greece entered a Dark Age, which lasted centuries. Writing was lost, the palace centers occupied by the Mycenaeans were largely abandoned, and people dispersed to live in small villages and family groups. Now, those that have traveled to Greece know it's a mountainous country.
It is a very beautiful country, with rolling hills and mountains on the mainland and beautiful volcanic and hilly islands peppering all around the Aegean. It is a very beautiful country.
Right. And so the good agricultural land is separated into relatively small pockets, hemmed in by the sea or the mountains or both. And in these small pockets of good farmland, the diminished and dispersed Greek population eventually coalesced into the various Greek poleis, or city-states, such as Athens, Thebes, Corinth, Argos, and Sparta. While these poleis remained politically independent, they shared a common language, a common alphabet adapted from Phoenician, as well as the Panhellenic athletic competitions open to all Greeks, like the Olympic Games, and Panhellenic religious sites like the Oracle at Delphi that we mentioned Lycurgus visiting at the top of the episode. The polis of Sparta developed in the Eurotas River Valley, located at the bottom of Greece's large southern peninsula called the Peloponnesus. And despite Herodotus' assertion that the Spartans were the most poorly governed state in Greece, they must have been doing something right, as they were able to conquer a neighboring people and enslave them en masse. These people became known as the Helots, and this population of slaves was in many ways the resource that made Lycurgus' reform package possible in the first place.
Very interesting, okay. Was there any mention of slaves being able to garner their freedom like their Roman counterparts in later centuries?
No, the Helots had no opportunity to gain their freedom,
okay,
as some slaves in other Greek cities sometimes did. They were considered property of Sparta as a whole, rather than individual Spartans, and were an extremely important labor source. Now, Plutarch tells us that Lycurgus was a somewhat distant member of one of the Spartan royal families. There are two royal lines in Sparta. But when the king and his heir both died suddenly, in separate incidents, Lycurgus was urged to take the throne, and he did so, but soon discovered that the queen, his sister-in-law, was pregnant with the deceased king's child. And so he declared that if this child were male, it should become king, and he would step back to a role of regent or guardian. At this point, the queen approached Lycurgus and made an offer to somehow abort the pregnancy and support Lycurgus as king. Plutarch writes that Lycurgus, quote, "Abhorring the woman's wickedness, he nevertheless did not reject her proposal, but, making show of closing with her, dispatched the messenger with thanks and expressions of joy, but dissuaded her earnestly from procuring herself to miscarry, which would impair her health, if not endanger her life. He himself, he said, would see to it that the child, as soon as born, should be taken out of the way. By such artifices having drawn on the woman to the time of her lying in, as soon as he heard that she was in labor, he sent persons to be by and observe all that passed, with orders that if it were a girl, they should deliver it to the woman, but if a boy, should bring it to him.
As it turned out, she did give birth to a son, and it was brought to Lycurgus, where he was meeting with the city magistrates, and he presented the boy to them as king, and named him Carolus. In rejecting her offer, though, Lycurgus had made an enemy of his sister-in-law and her relations. Plutarch reports that, troubled by this, and not knowing what it might come to, Lycurgus thought it was his wisest course to avoid their envy by a voluntary exile, and to travel from place to place until his nephew came to marriageable years, and, by having a son, had secured the succession. So Lycurgus left Sparta, traveling first to the island of Crete, where he made a study of the different forms of government he found there. He was impressed with some of the laws he found, but rejected others as useless. On Crete, he made a friend named Thales, and convinced him to emigrate to Sparta. Thales was a lyric poet by profession, but he is said to have paved the way for Lycurgus' reforms in Sparta through his songs dedicated to obedience and community.
I see. So while, I guess, Lycurgus was away from Sparta, this poet, Thales, was creating a sense of civic pride with his music?
Yeah. And I can see why Plutarch thought this would be worth mentioning. One can think of many examples of songs throughout history which have inspired national pride or strengthened different movements.
Yeah, and even today, the national anthems that we've heard millions of times sometimes have the power to move us. I mean, I always feel more patriotic when I hear our anthem, so yeah.
Right, exactly. So, yeah, I can see an insightful man like Lycurgus harnessing the talents of an exceptional poet like this Thales. After eventually taking his leave of Crete, Lycurgus sailed to Asia next. Asia to the Greeks did not mean the massive continent we know today. The Greeks didn't know of anything east of India, of which they had only vague knowledge. To the Greeks, Asia referred to what we now call Asia Minor, roughly the modern country of Turkey. On the Aegean coast of Asia Minor were a number of Greek cities. Collectively, the coastal region these cities were located in was called Ionia. It is to these Greek cities of Ionia that Lycurgus traveled, not the entire continent of Asia. It is also said that he traveled to Egypt, and he was impressed with the practice there of separating the soldiers from the citizenry. Plutarch dismisses reports that Lycurgus made further travels to Spain, Africa, and India, where he reportedly conferred with India's gymnosophists, or naked philosophers. As far as Plutarch can tell, these further travels of Lycurgus are only reported by one source, the Spartan Aristocrates, and so they cannot be credited due to the lack of substantiating accounts.
It seems like a reasonable conclusion to draw. I mean, there can't have been all that much happening in Spain at this point that would have motivated Lycurgus to sail up there.
Yeah, I agree. Not compared to the other places he had visited. I'm sure there are experts on the ancient history of Spain that would love to disagree with us, but
definitely.
In any event, it seems that Lycurgus' leadership qualities were sorely missed during this self-imposed exile of his, and influential Spartans were ready to be convinced to support his proposal to institute new laws when he returned, despite some initial apprehension from his nephew, King Carolus. It is at this point that Plutarch says Lycurgus made his trip to the oracle at Delphi, and received from the Pythia the oracle that Herodotus wrote about. And so, with the support of the leading Spartans and the stamp of approval from the god Apollo, Lycurgus got to work. His first act was the creation of a body called the Gerusia, which Plutarch, writing as he is in the early Roman imperial era, refers to as a senate. It was a body made up of 28 men over the age of 60, and the two Spartan kings, for a total of 30 men. The Gerusia was responsible for crafting proposals to put in front of the assembly of all adult male Spartans, who could simply vote yes or no to the proposal, which they did by yelling and banging on their shields. In similar fashion, when there was a vacancy on the Gerusia, the candidates to fill the position were simply marched in front of the assembly one by one, and the man who received the loudest cheers won.
Wow, very efficient system.
Yeah, it gets the job done. So, after establishing the Gerusia, Lycurgus took the more radical step of land redistribution. The Spartans at the time were in a state of extreme inequality, with wealth concentrated into the hands of a few, while many suffered from poverty and lack of employment. And so Lycurgus had all the land of Laconia divided into equal shares and distributed equally among the Spartans. In order to achieve equality of wealth as well as land, all gold and silver was brought in and replaced with the new currency of iron ingots. Plutarch says that, with the diffusion of this money, at once a number of vices were banished from Lacedaemon. For who would rob another of such a coin? Who would unjustly detain or take by force, or accept as a bribe, a thing which is not easy to hide nor a credit to have? There is now no more means of purchasing foreign goods and small wares. Merchants sent no shiploads into Laconian ports. No rhetoric master, no itinerant fortune teller, no harlot monger or gold or silversmith, engraver or jeweler set foot in a country which had no money, so that luxury, deprived little by little of that which fed and fomented it, wasted to nothing and died away of itself.
Wow, so he did this just to eradicate inequality?
Well, removing inequality, it seems, created the conditions which allowed the rest of the plan, which we'll see in a moment, to succeed. Another law he established was that henceforth, all adult Spartan men should eat their meals together, eating the same food. The men were divided into companies of 15, and each company ate at their own common mess hall, and each was required to contribute a prescribed amount of provisions to the mess. This, of course, should be doable as each man had an allotment of land, which was worked by the helot slave population, which was owned by all Spartans in common. Men had to eat at the mess hall every day, rather than with their families, the only excuse not to do so being if they were away hunting, in which case they would have to contribute any game they caught to the mess, or if they were observing a religious rite. The men were expected to drink only moderately at the mess hall, and then when returning home to sleep, they were forbidden any light, to accustom themselves to moving in the dark, apparently.
Wow, I'm not sure what else to say.
Yeah, and Plutarch says that this rule about eating together was the most controversial with the wealthier Spartans. A crowd of them gathered, yelling and throwing stones at Lycurgus, and he had to take to his heels, fleeing the mob. But one of the younger men was a strong runner and was gaining on Lycurgus. Lycurgus turned to face the youth and was struck in the face with a stick, gouging out one of his eyes.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, so Lycurgus then displayed his bloodied face to the crowd, and they were filled with shame and regret, and the law about eating meals at the mess hall stood. Maybe the resistance to eating in common came from the simple food they were required to eat, which included the infamous black broth that foreigners found vile, but older Spartans apparently relished.
Yes, I think I've heard about this black broth. Isn't it just like boiled pig's legs, blood, vinegar, and salt, or something like that?
Yeah, and I think you can actually find videos on YouTube that show you how to make this soup, wow. But I'm not sure why you'd want to, but it's out there, I guess, if anyone's interested. Anyway, it wasn't just the men of Sparta who would live differently than other Greeks. Unlike in other Greek cities, the women of Sparta were also required to exercise outdoors, running, wrestling, and throwing javelins. Lycurgus reasoned they would be better able to endure childbirth and would have stronger children if the women of Sparta were fit. And if the stories told of them are true, it seems that the women of Sparta were fierce and strong-willed, every bit a match for the Spartan men. Plutarch reports that when a foreign woman said to the Spartan queen Gorgo that the women of Sparta were the only women of the world who could rule men, Gorgo replied, "With good reason, for we are the only women who bring forth men." Now, Lycurgus knew that for such a radical system to work, it all depended on the education of the youth, and here he took extreme measures indeed. To begin with, the decision of whether to even raise a child belonged not to the parents, but to the elders of the community, who judged the infant, and if it was not well formed, it was exposed in the chasm below Mount Taygetus.
Well, that's harsh.
Yeah. Harsh is the word for Sparta. And it only gets harsher. At age 7, male Spartans are taken from their families, and they enter the agoge. The agoge was overseen by an official called a paidonomos, which literally translates as boy herd.
Okay.
The boys' hair was cut short, and they were divided into companies and lived together, each company being led by an older boy. After age 12, they were no longer allowed any undergarment, and were given one cloak to last a year. Their rations were meager, and Plutarch says that they were meager on purpose, as it would encourage the boys to steal to supplement their rations. The boys were not punished for stealing, but would be punished harshly for being caught stealing. There's a story of a Spartan youth who stole a fox and was hiding it under his cloak, and the fox started chewing at his belly, but he didn't want to reveal that he'd stolen the fox, and it just let the fox chew him to death. That might sound like a ridiculous story, but Plutarch actually says that he himself, when visiting Sparta, saw youths being whipped in front of the Temple of Artemis until they died. So, yeah, harsh is the right word. Also, at about this age of 12, the boys were expected to accept an older teenage boy as a lover/mentor. And this was part of their education, really. If a younger boy failed in some way, for example, crying out in pain during training, it was their older lover who was punished for not instructing the younger boy better. The Spartan male youth completed the agoge at age 18, after which they would need to gain acceptance to one of the adult male mess halls. Failing to gain membership to a mess essentially meant you were not a Spartan. The next thing a Spartan was expected to do was marry, and failing to do so came with social penalties. However, this being Sparta, even marriage would have to be different. For the first years of a marriage, the young husband is obliged to spend his time with the mess, and is only able to snatch a few moments here and there to visit his wife. Plutarch, though, sees some benefit in this, saying of the young couple, "Their interviews being thus difficult and rare, served not only for continual exercise of their self-control, but brought them together with their bodies healthy and vigorous, and their affections fresh and lively, unsated and undulled by easy access and long continuance with each other. While their partings were always early enough to leave behind unextinguished in each of them some remainder fire of longing."
Okay, so Plutarch believes that absence makes the heart grow stronger?
Yeah, it seems that way. Another feature of Spartan marriage that was different from the Greek norm is that certain types of extramarital arrangements were not frowned upon if it led to more healthy Spartan children being born. An elderly Spartan's younger wife might, for example, have a child with a younger Spartan man. Now, to go back to the educational system for a moment, it wasn't just focused on military virtue, though this was obviously paramount. The Spartan youths were also instructed in music. The poet Pindar writes of Sparta, "Counsels of wise elders hear, and the young men's conquering spear, and dance, and song, and joy appear." In addition, they were taught to speak well, though the focus seems to have been on short, pithy remarks. This is the origin of the term laconic, like we mentioned earlier. Plutarch relates a number of famous Spartan quotes. For example, when an Athenian laughed at the Spartan short swords, King Aegis of Sparta replied, "We find them long enough to reach our enemies with."
Aha, nice comeback.
King Carolus, Lycurgus' nephew, was asked why his uncle had made so few laws and responded, "Men of few words require few laws." So they were men of few words, and they were tough as nails, with no luxuries, but they enjoyed music and dancing, and they actually grew their hair long as adults as well. The focus was really on excellence in combat, though. They trained intensely as youths and even as adults. With the Helots handling the agricultural labor and a third class of citizen, the Perioikoi, who handled all trades and mercantile activity, an adult male Spartan typically spent their time assisting with the training of the youths or perfecting their own combat skills. To understand the value of all this training, we need to understand the type of infantry warfare that had developed in Greece. In Homer, battles seemed to involve two sides facing off, throwing projectiles at each other, with warriors squaring off in individual combat in an uncoordinated manner. This had given way to hoplite warfare, which involved men fighting in a tightly packed infantry formation called a phalanx, usually 8 rows deep, with the width varying depending on the size of the unit. Each warrior carried a round shield about 3 feet in diameter, made of curved pieces of wood joined together and covered in bronze, often painted with a cool picture of something like maybe a bee, or a bird, a bull's head, or monstrous gorgon head. These shields could weigh over 20 pounds, and they featured an Argive grip, named for the city-state of Argos. This was a handle near the edge of the shield, so you would slide your left arm through a leather strap and then grip this handle at the edge of the heavy shield. And you can imagine that you'd be able to wield this thing with considerable power. Picture something like Captain America's shield, maybe a little bit bigger. Though there are no reports of anyone popping off their shield and throwing it at their enemies like a discus or anything.
Yeah, well, that would definitely be cool to see, though.
Yeah, definitely, though I'm not sure how effective in real life, but I guess that's besides the point anyway. The hoplite's kit also consisted of a cuirass, greaves, and helmet, which for early hoplites was also made of bronze, though gradually as time went on, a lighter kit became more common. The most common helmet at first was the iconic Corinthian helmet. It was made from one sheet of bronze, shaped to cover the whole head, with a narrow slit for the mouth and the eyes. Not a lot of good peripheral vision there, and you couldn't hear very well, but a very cool-looking helmet. The principal weapon was a spear, 10 feet long, and a short sword was carried as a secondary weapon. The first rank would hold their spears in front of them. The shield on their left arm would shield partly themselves and partly the man to the left of them. The second and third ranks also projected their spears out over the shoulders of the men in front of them. So you'd be looking at a hedge of spears at the front of the phalanx. And so these two heavy, bronze-clad, tightly packed phalanxes would crash into each other with tremendous force. You can imagine that many of the spears would be broken in the initial impact or soon after, and after a while the battle would soon turn into a grueling battle of attrition. Both sides would be pushing with their shields and stabbing with their swords and spears until one side broke and ran. Now, all Greeks seem to have taken athletics and physical fitness rather more seriously than the average Joe today. And warfare was so common that most adult men had some experience at some point, but to most Greeks, training outside of campaign season was just not happening. They had other things to do. So you can imagine that the Spartans had a considerable advantage in battle. It was pros versus amateurs, basically. In fact, for the Spartans, war was actually a nice break from training, and in preparation for a battle, they would beautify their kit and their long hair. Plutarch writes that when they were in the field, their exercises were generally more moderate, their fare not so hard, nor so strict a hand held over them by officers, so that they were the only people in the world to whom war gave repose. When their army was drawn up in battle array and the enemy near, the king sacrificed a goat, commanded the soldiers to set their garlands upon their heads, and the pipers to play the hymn to Castor, and himself began the paean of advance. It was at once a magnificent and a terrible sight to see them march on to the tune of their flutes, without any disorder in their ranks, discomposure in their minds, or change in their countenance, calmly and cheerfully moving with the music to the deadly fight. The Spartan king always had next to him in battle someone who had won in the Olympic Games, and Plutarch relates the story of a Spartan wrestler who was offered a bribe to throw the match, but refused to do so and won the match. And someone said to him after, "And now, Sir Lacedaemonian, what are you the better for your victory?" And the Spartan answered with a smile, "I shall fight next to the king." So it was an incredible honor to win at the Olympics and then fight next to your king in battle. And you really have to think that these Spartans would have made an impressive sight marching towards you in battle with their bright red cloaks and their calm demeanor. This is the type of citizen that Lycurgus's laws had helped create. And Plutarch defends Lycurgus's laws against those who would say that it produces good soldiers, but not justice. He thinks that would be a fair criticism to apply to the Crypteia, but he doesn't believe that the Crypteia was actually an invention of Lycurgus, rather that its formation came about at a later date after a devastating earthquake which led to a large Helot uprising in its aftermath. The Crypteia was a sort of Spartan secret police, made up of Spartan youths which terrorized the Helot population. We may go into the Crypteia a little bit more in a later episode, but for now I'll just accept Plutarch's assertion that the Crypteia was not created by Lycurgus. Now, Lycurgus, upon reaching old age, decided that even his death should be as deliberate and purposeful as the laws that he had created for Sparta. And Plutarch tells us that Lycurgus decided to put an end to himself by a total abstinence from food, thinking it a statesman's duty to make his very death, if possible, an act of service to the state, and even in the end of his life to give some example of virtue.
I'm not sure I understand what the virtue is in committing suicide by refusing to eat.
No, I guess that I don't either. Plutarch seems to feel that the virtue in these actions is obvious because he doesn't provide any explanation himself. Maybe Lycurgus felt like he was surplus population because he was older. Or maybe fasting to death was just a display of the iron will that he wanted Spartans to develop. In any event, his laws would live long after him, and it was Plutarch's belief that Lycurgus's laws allowed Sparta to become the dominant city-state in Greece for centuries. To quote Plutarch, "As the poets feign of Hercules, that, with his lion skin and his club, he went over the world punishing lawless and cruel tyrants, so may it be said of the Lacedaemonians, that, with a common staff and a coarse coat, they gained the willing and joyful obedience of Greece, through whose whole extent they suppressed unjust usurpations and despotisms, arbitrated in war, and composed civil dissensions, and this often without so much as taking down one buckler, but barely by sending some one single deputy, to whose direction all at once submitted, like bees swarming and taking their places around their prince. Such a fund of order and equity, enough and to spare for others, existed in their state." Well, Chris, that about wraps up the life of Lycurgus. Through his legendary life, we see the emergence in Sparta of a powerful and very different model for a polis, or city-state, than we will see in the other Greek polis. And in later episodes, it will be interesting to contrast the Spartan way of life with that of the Athenian people, especially as these two polis will come into conflict in the centuries to come. But that's getting ahead of ourselves.
Well, I'm certainly intrigued by these Spartans, and I'm beginning to understand how these people earned such a reputation for themselves. And the story of Lycurgus is an interesting one. Here is a man who passed up the chance to be a king in favor of his infant nephew, and then goes into self-imposed exile and travels the Eastern Mediterranean studying different forms of government, then returns home to convince the Spartans to adopt this radical new military-focused constitution. Well, I hope everyone listening enjoyed the episode as much as I have. Please join us next time where we will return to Rome for the exciting conclusion of the life of Romulus.
Thanks for listening to Plutarch's Greeks and Romans podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, feel free to head over to our blog at plutarchsgreeksromans.wordpress.com or check out Plutarch's Greeks and Romans on Facebook. And don't forget to leave us a review on whichever podcast service you are using. See you next time.